Is it okay to say no? This is the world. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. How open should a country's doors be to migrants? That's a hotly debated question both in Europe and here.
I have been stunned sometimes as someone who identifies as a moderate liberal at how many of my liberal friends shut down immediately when I say I think we need to have limits on our immigration to this country.
We hear from a self-described restrictionist. Also, Britain's National Sperm Bank puts out a call for donors. Men of steel need not apply.
We don't necessarily need Superman. We need ordinary men doing extraordinary things.
Plus, the joys of driving an icebreaker.
Icebreakers are the only kind of ships where you're actually encouraged to crash into things.
And a big, big parade in Beijing. That's all ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. There seems to be no end to Europe's migrant crisis or to the suffering of the desperate migrants themselves. Today, bodies washed up on a beach in Turkey. They were Syrian refugees whose boat capsized on the way to Greece. And in the Hungarian capital of Budapest, hundreds of people stranded at a train station protested for a second day. They're demanding that Hungarian authorities let them proceed north to Germany. Nabi Bulos of the New York Times is in Hungary. He's been traveling with the migrants.
Well, right now we're in Budapest, actually. And just a second ago, I was at the Budapest Keleti train station. This is the main train station, as I understand it, in Budapest. And that's where, actually, now you have the site of a really strange, almost surreal refugee camp that's grown outside the station and in its lower levels, actually mostly in the station's environs, really. And you're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of people congregated there, sleeping, eating, you know, trying to basically make their way to Germany from there. It's just a very surreal scene, truly.
The other thing I find interesting, you know, with all due respect to Hungary, is that these guys, they don't want to stay in Hungary. They don't want to stay in Budapest. They want to transit through to get north. Why not just kind of let them do that?
Well, because, I mean, the fact is that is what was being done, let's say, in Serbia and in Macedonia. I mean, before, it was quite difficult to cross those countries, right? I mean, you had gangs of people who were preying on migrants. Now this has changed. I mean, now essentially there is an illegal, but let's say accepted framework for a migrant to go from Greece into Macedonia and from there into Serbia, right? I mean, the trouble starts in Hungary, really. And the fact is, yes, you're right. Hungary doesn't want these people. It would be easier for them to just say, hey, go ahead, you know, get on the trains, et cetera. And in fact, it would be a source of income as well, for that matter. But, I mean, for some reason, Hungary has taken it upon itself to be the bulwark of Northern Europe. I'm not entirely sure why, I'll be honest with you. It's a pretty thankless job from what I can tell.
I don't know if this sounds like a prurient question, but, I mean, what about the basic elements of life? How are these people getting food, water, going to the bathroom, that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, let's say with great difficulty overall, you know, I mean, they're going around different areas, you know, and it's all very, very annoying. But the fact is they're making do. I mean, I've seen people wash their babies in fountains. I've seen people go to the bathroom in the unlikeliest of places. I've seen people getting food, I mean, wherever they can, handouts, et cetera. I mean, finally, people do find a way. The fact is that these are people with identities and they had a life before this, and they try to maintain a semblance of that life in some way, shape, or form. I mean, for example, today I saw a guy who is addicted to ergile, which is like a hubbly bubbly. I guess if you've seen Alice in Wonderland, you've seen that caterpillar that smokes that water pipe.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he managed to carry on with him all the way from Greece to here. I mean, we're talking about someone who managed to carry a contraption for smoking across several borders and has it with him now in the train station. And he smokes, you know, whenever he can. I mean, other people sort of, you know, have songs. They play card games. They just do what they can because, I mean, finally you have no other choice. They simply have to be here. They simply have to find a way. I mean, I just want to get out of here. But then they also have to pass the time. It's a mind-numbing boredom that is the worst part of it, in all honesty.
Nabi, this is, of course, a tragic human story, but it's also a political one. And I wonder if you've been able to speak with any Hungarians while you were there and how they feel about the situation.
I mean, there's been a large variety of responses. Some people are very much, you know, with helping the refugees. They have, I mean, you know, personal handouts, or I should say private donations come in every day, right? There's no lack of that. But there are others, of course, who, I mean, feel that enough is enough, and Hungary doesn't need any more people, for one thing. And more importantly, these people are defacing, if you will, an ancient and, I guess, very, very elegant train station. And of course, I mean, they're also, you know, sabotaging the train station's working. I mean, the fact is, one can't ever strike a balance in this, I find, right? I mean, do you try to satisfy the refugees who really are in need, but at the same time, do you try to satisfy your own populace who is very sad and also at the same time, you know, I mean, they need to get on with their daily lives. I suppose it's a constant battle between those two extremes. And I've seen both those extremes, I mean, in front of me in Hungarian society.
Nabi Bulos with the New York Times. He's been traveling with refugees as they make their way across Europe. Thanks, Nabi, for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Striking a balance, as we just heard, is difficult when discussing the kind of migration crisis that Europe is now experiencing. Some also criticize us, that is the media, for oversimplifying.
There is an inevitable tendency, for well-intended reasons, to cast immigration as a story of vulnerable migrants seeking inclusion in societies and facing resistance from hard-hearted nativists or xenophobes or bigots.
That's Jerry Kammer. He's a fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors limits on immigration. And taking that stance, Kammer says, shouldn't automatically label someone as racist or a hater.
All those labels are tossed around quite copiously, and unfortunately, I think they have the effect of chilling the debate and making many people who would like to be part of a well-informed discussion fearful of entering into that discussion because they're concerned that they themselves might be labeled as a racist, one of the absolutely worst labels that anyone in our society can receive, of course.
Is there a way, do you think, to have this discussion without throwing around the names? Bleeding heart on one hand, xenophobe on the other?
There are many people who have the very progressive idea that human beings should be absolutely free to move as they desire. And there are others, who, like me, who think that there are good liberal reasons to want to limit immigration for the sake of our society, order in our society, and the successful inclusion of immigrants into our society, those whom we do admit. We simply cannot, I believe, accept all those who want to come to our country.
Well, from your point of view, what are the unintended consequences of more open borders?
You know, I like to tell family that, look, immigration isn't rocket science. That's because it's far more complicated. It affects so many spheres of our life as a country, as a society, as an economy. Some immediate effects are in labor markets. Other effects that I saw when I was living in Arizona throughout the 1990s are in neighborhoods, schools, healthcare systems, and just the general sense that people in Arizona had, where the undocumented population grew by hundreds of thousands in a few years, the general sense of being overwhelmed. And some people use the term invasion, a word that got hackles up in some quarters because people are saying, how can you talk about these vulnerable human beings as invading? Well, when you talk to the people living in Cochise or Santa Cruz County or Yuma County, Arizona, and you realize the pressure that they were facing with, in some nights, hundreds or even a couple thousand people coming across illegally from the Mexican state of Sonora, you understand how they have a sense of being invaded.
You look at the pictures. These are kids, families drowning in the Mediterranean. These are people, you know, now in Mexico and Central America facing just incredible violence. You know, it's hard to look at this stuff and think about being restrictionist.
I agree. And I think humanitarian concerns are the immediate value that must be stressed whenever we're facing a fellow human being in dire circumstances. When you think of someone in a boat that's foundering off the coast of Italy or off the coast of Libya trying to get to Italy, you absolutely must reach out and provide aid and comfort to those fellow human beings. The larger discussion is, what are our obligations, legal under international law or morally and ethically, to receive those who wish to come to our country, believing that there are certain limits to our capacity to do so.
Jerry Kammer is a senior research fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, D.C. He's working on a book about what he sees as efforts to mute the immigration debate by labeling restrictionists, as he calls himself, as racists and xenophobes. Jerry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, China will celebrate Victory Day. It's the 70th anniversary of the end of the Chinese People's War of Resistance against Japanese aggression, or as we call it, World War II. Plans are set for a huge military parade in Beijing, but residents of the Chinese capital are under strict orders to stay home.
We received notices saying that we should not go out on our balconies or really even look out our windows. We weren't allowed to have guests stay over tonight, and we were told not to use the gas, the cooking gas.
That's Los Angeles Times China correspondent Julie Mackinnon.
Around any big event, China takes what many Americans would consider to be extraordinary security measures. They do have a number of foreign heads of state in Beijing, as well as huge amounts of military equipment. So I think you put those two things together, and it's a recipe for a lot of extreme measures.
Yeah, one of those extreme measures is to bring in monkeys to climb trees and destroy birds' nests. I mean, this all does seem quite over the top.
They're going to bring about 200 aircraft to this parade, which is the highest number they've ever brought. And I think they're very sensitive about anything going wrong. So, yes, the monkeys have been called out to destroy some birds' nests, lest the birds might fly into the pathway of these aircraft. But it's not the first time that we've seen this. Before, I think it was the 18th Party Congress, there was a report in state-run media that people who fly pigeons were being told to keep their pigeons cooped up for the day. And then they did release some, I believe it was doves in Tiananmen Square, and the birds had cavity checks performed before they were allowed to be released.
Oof. There's other things, though. I mean, this is a parade without any spectators, right?
This is a made-for-TV event for sure. There are, I think it's maybe 19,000 quote-unquote ordinary people who have been invited to watch from the bleachers, but it's not like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade where you can just amble down to the curb with your lawn chair and expect to gawk at what's being paraded down the street. There's absolutely no way for ordinary folks in Beijing to watch this other than basically on their televisions.
So, Julie, if you were to go out on your balcony, which of course you will not do, what might you see in this parade?
There's going to be 12,000 soldiers along with about 200 aircraft. Missiles will be paraded. A small contingent of troops from other countries, including Belarus, Cuba, Pakistan, Mexico, Mongolia, Russia, Kazakhstan, Serbia, and Kyrgyzstan. There'll be a couple hundred aged vets from World War II. I believe the oldest one is 102. And Xi Jinping will give a speech to kick off the activities.
It does seem like a Cold War relic, though. Why is China still doing this sort of thing?
Well, this is the first time China has held a military parade to basically celebrate what it sees as, you know, its victory over a foreign power, in this case, Japan. China has long felt that it's a source of national humiliation that China was repeatedly defeated by foreign powers, including Britain, France, Japan, in the 1800s, 1900s. And coming out from this period of national shame has been sort of a long-held goal of Chinese leaders, and it's part of the Chinese dream that Xi Jinping has articulated, a strong country. And this is a way for Xi to demonstrate that he is creating a strong country.
Julie Mackinnon with the LA Times. Exciting times there in Beijing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Aaron.
And you're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter with The World. In Britain, as in many countries, there is growing demand for sperm donors from couples who are unable to conceive on their own, and increasingly demand is outstripping supply. So last year, the British government came up with a solution, set up a national sperm bank to try and make it easier for couples to get access to medically checked sperm. The only problem, after a year of operating, the bank has just 9 approved donors. Laura Vitjens is head of the British National Sperm Bank. Laura, 9 donors doesn't sound like very many. Why so few?
I recognize that people say 9, that's not a lot. But actually, I turn that around. I say, at this stage, to have 9, wow. We didn't set out, not in our first year anyway, to resolve the national crisis. We didn't say we're going to do thousands. But this is a very good, I guess, start for us, because we know what works, we know what doesn't work, and this is a great place to start.
Still, 9 seems like a pretty small number.
I know what you're saying. It's, first of all, it's not just 9 donors in the UK. It has, we are 600 to 700 donors. Now,
But what is the difference then between the 600 and the 9?
Recruiting donors is very hard work. Not only do you have to appeal to the man to do something which is perceived as being smutty, what it takes is, in the UK at least, is for a donor to go to a clinic about twice a week for a period of 3 to 4 months. So the whole process of donating to get enough samples, it can take between 6 and 9 months. We have to take a sperm sample and freeze it. And it's a thawing process that actually kills about 80 to 90% of the sperm. So you'll find that men who actually have got proven fertility, so our fathers themselves, when it comes to becoming a sperm donor, 80 to 90% of them aren't good enough. So it's an uphill, forgive the pun, struggle for finding men who can commit to this 9 months and have good enough sperm.
So I mean, in essence, you do need a kind of Superman or a man with super sperm, I guess.
Well, I think you're right to say it's a man with a super sperm. We don't necessarily need Superman. We need ordinary men doing extraordinary things. Ultimately, we need men who are willing to help childless couples. We need men who look like, in that sense, ordinary men. But because, of course, the majority of heterosexual couples who require a sperm donor want somebody who looks like them. If you are of average height and dark hair, brown eyes, and you don't necessarily want a 6'4" blonde guy, which may look good on a picture, but if you have a child that stands out like a sore thumb, that's not what they want. So we're looking for extraordinary man in a sense that they want to make a difference, and with, yes, super sperm, but they don't have to wear a cape and do all sorts of other funny things.
There is another interesting wrinkle there in Britain, because children born from sperm donations are able to trace their biological fathers. You know, if I'm one of those 9 guys, I can have a lot of kids come looking for me.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's open in the UK, which means that donors can be traced, or let's flip it, donor conceived can find out who their donor is by the time they're 18. Now, that doesn't make them financially or legally responsible, but of course there's a moral obligation, and it's exactly how we counsel the donors as well. You know, this is what can happen. You need to be ready for it. If you're not ready for it, then don't donate. But there is a very valid reason for that. There's more and more people who are donor conceived want to know who their biological donor is, their biological father is. But it's not about looking for replacement father. It is looking for somebody, you know, where does my curly hair come from, or my musical talent, or things like that.
So essentially, you're looking for people who want to do something good for humanity.
Absolutely. We're looking for men, ordinary men doing extraordinary things, who are prepared to help other people with the greatest gift there is to give, which is the gift of a family. That's the message we need to carry on.
Laura Vitjens is the head of the British National Sperm Bank. She joined us from near London. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sometimes the crisis is too few offspring, and sometimes it's far, far too many. That's the situation in Istanbul with cats. They're a fixture of the Turkish city. And whether locals like it or not, Istanbul has developed a reputation as a kingdom for cats. But the reality, some say, is much bleaker, as Dalia Mortada reports.
It's 5 p.m., feeding time for these Istanbul street cats. 65-year-old Vesel has been visiting the cats in this park twice a day for the past 10 years. The sweet old man with kind blue eyes can't stand to see them hungry. And there are lots of mouths to feed in this place, nicknamed Cat Park. The park is an attraction in this high-end Istanbul neighborhood. Cool-looking guys with hipster beards sit casually as cats curl up on their laps. Kids run around trying to pet every kitten they can find. I often come by for my own kitten therapy.
Hi. You like being carried?
It can be a heaven for cat lovers, but not always.
Yardım edenler için iyi, kediler için.
Vesel says it's great when he sees people helping the cats, but there are plenty of cruel people too. He saw one woman recently. She was so terrible. I told her to go away, he says, getting worked up. I was so mad, I cursed at her.
Oh, there's Princess. She's so sweet.
That's the fluffy orange. The fluffy, white. I can see her from here. She looks like a princess.
She is a princess.
Hilary Sable is a British woman who's been taking care of the cats in her Istanbul neighborhood for the past 5 years. She says it's really tough to see Istanbul portrayed as a cat safe haven in the media when she's part of a network that takes care of the animals.
The people who come here come to the areas where the foreigners live or the tourist areas, and they do not see the 90% of Istanbul where the cats are dying in the street from neglect, illness, being kicked by the local kids.
Hilary has become a sort of fixture in her neighborhood for the human and feline residents.
I give her food every day when I walk down to the clinic. Hey, Princess! Hello! Hello, fat girl! Hello! Yeah! In my bag, there's a little bag of food. If you can give her some of that.
Okay.
Hello, you little fat girl.
She feeds a few dozen cats every day. She knows when an unfamiliar animal has entered her neighborhood or when a cat goes missing. Istanbul's furry residents have been around for centuries. Old depictions of the city often include at least one cat. They've been loved by Ottoman sultans and even the Prophet Muhammad.
Hazreti Muhammed savaşa gidiyormuş.
According to Aynur, an Istanbul resident visiting the cat park, the Muslim prophet loved cats so much that one time he diverted his entire army so he wouldn't disrupt a mother feeding her kittens in the middle of the road. But this neighborhood isn't really the norm in Istanbul. The reality is that there are hundreds of thousands of cats in the city, in dumpsters and garbage cans, spreading disease and getting hurt on Istanbul's crowded streets. While there are some government services, there aren't many. And so this so-called heaven for cats is often more of a hell for the felines and the people who care about them. For the world, I'm Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
After Dahlia's story, I feel obliged to tell you that we have cats on our website. Go there now. You know you want to. It's PRI.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Aaron Schachter. President Obama wants more U.S. icebreakers in the Arctic to compete with Russia in the region, and this retired Coast Guard admiral agrees.
If you can't really be on the scene, you're really not going to be a player in the long run. So I think it's vital for the country to get on with this.
Plus, a legendary Nazi gold train, emphasis on legendary. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. What do you get when you combine poster designs from Seattle, Havana, and Tehran? Well, I can't quite say it on the radio, but I'll spell it. It's an SHT show. Full name, the Seattle, Havana, Tehran Poster Design Show. It opens this weekend in Seattle. Daniel Smith and Pepe Menendez are two of the curators. The show features poster art by designers in those three cities I mentioned. Smith's the one who first came up with the idea.
It started almost 10 years ago with a trip to Cuba. So I went to Havana and I met Pepe, who's sitting here with me. We had an exhibition in Havana and was half American designers and half Cuban designers. And in that visit, I saw how amazing the work was and saw that what was happening was very similar to what was happening in Seattle in terms of silkscreen posters and, you know, incredible poster content, kind of a rebirth of the poster. And I thought, we really have to get together and do something as one.
And Pepe, when you first heard about this, did you think it was a great idea?
Yes, I thought it was a wonderful idea. I had no information about what was happening in Seattle at that time. Dan told me about this music scene poster production, and I was really surprised, and it was stimulating to be part of that right from the beginning.
And how do you guys go about curating and finding all the images?
We worked long distance. I mean, we're pretty aware of what's happening in each other's countries, you know, especially in Havana and in Tehran. The community is pretty small. The design community in Seattle, there's a pretty tight poster-making community around music. So it's very possible for us to look at what's happening in our cities and grab posters, you know, images, and start playing. So essentially we sent posters to each other by email, looking for similarities between things. We're missing our good friend Iman Rod, who is in Tehran. We worked with him long distance and sent each other PDFs just to look at combinations. We went through probably hundreds of combinations to land on the few that are in the show.
As Dan said, the posters are put together in such a way that you have images from Seattle, from Havana, and from Tehran that all sort of go together. I wonder how you were able to find such incredible images from different places that seem to evoke the same themes or the same general image. You know, there are horses, there are ravens, and things like that.
When we did the very first show, I had this idea that not only could we just hang posters in the same space, but we could possibly put them next to each other so that they start a conversation. It doesn't surprise me anymore that there are so many commonalities. When I went to Tehran, when I went to Cuba, there are so many things that link us together that we're not aware of, possibly because we never see some of these things in the media. At least in America, we never see Tehran. You know, before I left, I couldn't imagine the city and the people. And the people are incredible, and they want the same things we want: better communication, better relations. So the imagery, to me, it's not surprising that it's so similar anymore. I feel like there's common themes that run between us, even though it's maybe it's subconscious, but it's so human.
Pepe, were there any themes or images that you were surprised that the three cities had in common?
I had no idea what's going on in the two other cities. And it's really surprising that you can find, as you mentioned, for example, these three horses. Once we came out with this triple, I was really amazed. I was, it's almost unbelievable that there's three designers and more or less in the same time came up with a poster solution for something that, by the way, has nothing to do with horses. I mean, these are not for horse exhibition or
right.
a horse shop. It's for something else. It's for music, for theater, for other things. But in the three cases, the designer has chosen this image, this symbol, and it almost looks done by the same person in a way.
Yeah, it does. The horse, the three horses are facing the same way. The musculature is very similar.
And the pattern, there's like a circular pattern in all of them. So yeah, there are these incredible coincidences.
You're still working on setting the show up in Tehran. I wonder in general, though, what challenges you've had trying to get this thing going as a three-nation art show.
Our complications are more about shipping.
So really?
Between, yes.
Well, you know, I asked this question as if it were just a logistical issue. You know, you got to get an art show to three countries. But
right.
these are, you know, these countries are bad guys. You know, Cuba and Iran, we don't
and
talk
the United
to them.
States. Let's
and
not
the United
exclude
States,
ourselves.
Right.
Exactly. So I think, well, one of the beautiful things about going to these places is seeing that there's truly a difference between the relations between our governments and the relations between people. There's nothing standing in the way of us working together. Me working with the communists down there in Cuba or me working with Iranians, there's no barriers to doing this except trying to get posters to each other. The beauty of a poster show is we can wrap it up in a tube and deliver it to each other, you know, hand deliver it. We find someone who's traveling between the United States and Cuba. We give them posters. They deliver it to my friend Pepe down there, or he does the same. He finds someone coming to the United States. That's the tricky part, is that there is no direct shipping. We have to find people who can help us out, carry these posters by hand.
Daniel Smith and Pepe Menendez, they are two of the curators of the SHT show. We'll let listeners put the letters together themselves. The Seattle leg of the show opens this weekend at the Bumbershoot Festival. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you can't make the Bumbershoot Fest this weekend, no worries. You can see some of these really amazing posters at PRI.org. India is consumed right now with a celebrity murder case. The victim was a young woman who was found dead in a forested area 3 years ago. Police now say she was a wealthy socialite named Sheena Bora, and last week they made some arrests in connection with the crime, sparking a media firestorm in India. Sandeep Roy is an editor at firstpost.com in Calcutta. He says this is one very complicated case.
In fact, I think a social media update that has been doing the rounds probably sums it up the best. It goes, a second wife of her third husband is charged, along with her second husband, of killing her daughter from her first husband, who, the daughter, was having an affair with her third husband's son from his first wife.
What?
Clear as mud?
Yeah, clear as mud. Good work. Break it down for
basically,
us.
To break it down, what happened was that a couple of weeks ago, Indrani Mukherjee, who is the wife of Peter Mukherjee, who is a big media honcho here, the former CEO of Fox-owned Star India TV network, she was arrested. First, she was accused of having killed her sister in 2012 and dumped the body along with her driver and her ex-husband. Then it turned out that the woman she was passing off as her sister was her daughter, and Peter claimed he didn't even know that. And then a son surfaced who claimed that she had tried to poison him at the same time. In a further twist, the current husband, Peter, revealed that the missing girl was having an affair with his son from an earlier marriage, something the wife was dead set against. And for 3 years, this young woman, Sheena Bora, was gone. No one filed any missing person report. They just believed that she had deactivated her Facebook account and was living in the United States.
I think you just laid it out as clearly as possible, but it's all still really confusing. What is the possible motive for the woman to kill her sister, now daughter?
Yeah, and you have to understand that in this case, there is what is happening right now is an investigation. The only trial that's happening is the media trial. So all the motives and everything that are swirling around in Indian media are all coming from media, or as they say, sources within close to the investigation. The police have not stated the motive yet. But several motives that are doing the rounds are that, A, there was a lot of money involved, that Peter Mukherjee and his wife had funneled away a lot of money from a failed media venture, and some of that money was with Sheena Bora, and she was refusing to return that money. There is stories about the mother being afraid that if Sheena Bora in fact married Peter's son, then all his inheritance would pass to them and not to her other daughter by a second marriage. This other daughter belonged to the former husband who has been charged as an accomplice in this murder. But again, I have to say, these are all theories that are out there. And what's striking about this case is in the desperate rush to have wall-to-wall coverage of this case, media is coming up with theories every couple of hours, and nothing is off the table, even rumors, unsubstantiated rumors about incest and things like that.
In a way, this kind of sounds like India's O.J. Simpson moment.
In a way, it is, except much of what happened with O.J. Simpson happened during the course of the trial. And as I said, what is happening here right now is just an investigation. The only trial that's happening is the media trial. And the danger of this also is that that whether this woman is guilty or not of this horrible crime, you know, she will one day have her day in court and giving her side of the story. But when the media is the self-appointed judge, jury, executioner, then it changes the complexion entirely, because the media is going ahead and tracking down witnesses and family members before even the police can get to them.
And also commenting on Indrani's mothering abilities.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there are socialites who are going on television saying, well, at least I'm a better mother. You know, even if I've neglected my children in other ways, I'm a better mother than Indrani. So all in all, it has been a really ugly spectacle of seeing people, you know, using this case to drive a correlation between ambition and and literally the killer instinct.
Sandeep Roy is senior editor at firstpost.com. He joined us from Calcutta. Thanks as always, Sandeep.
Thank you, Aaron. Pleasure.
India's neighbor to the north, Nepal, is slowly recovering from that deadly earthquake back in May. But in many ways, Nepalis are still working to overcome the damage done by the disaster. And it's not just humans who were hit hard. Tens of thousands of farm animals were killed, and the intimate relationship between rural Nepalis and their animals was badly disrupted. Nepal-based producer Laura Spiro brings us this story of how farm animals and people are helping each other face the future.
I'm in the kitchen with Amma. Today we're making rice pudding in celebration because we have a new baby buffalo. When a buffalo is born in the village of Kaskikot, it's treated a lot like a human birth. Today, Amma and I are cooking a special meal in honor of baby O'Neill, who was born last week. O'Neill! People and animals nurture tender relationships here in Nepal. And when an earthquake earlier this year took nearly 9,000 human lives, it also claimed an estimated 55,000 farm animals and nearly 500,000 birds. The effects of these losses have been felt by both people and animals, especially in villages like Tripursur, 100 miles east of Amma's house, where nearly every single one of the 947 houses was destroyed. Binda Thapa shows me a photo of her house after the earthquake. It's a pile of rocks with two pieces of tin strewn over it. She says her buffalo was pinned down under its collapsed shed for hours and was jittery for weeks afterwards. For a while, it didn't even provide milk predictably. Maybe, she thinks, out of fear or shock. Farm animals play a vital role in the lives of rural Nepalis. Buffalo are raised for milk, and their waste is used for fertilizer and mixed into the mud in traditional stone houses. Goats are sold for meat. Oxen plow, and chickens provide eggs. People like Amma and Binda spend most of their day caring for their livestock, beginning with milking in the morning, and then cutting grass for feed and carrying it home in heavy loads each afternoon. From the outside, it's easy to reduce livestock to economics, and that's certainly one aspect of their existence. But they're also members of the family. You have to love the animals you raise more than your children or parents, Amma tells me. It's a lot of work. The reward for providing that love is that we humans get to eat. And it's not just humans who suffer when their animals are harmed. The reverse is also true. Livestock often have one primary caretaker, like Binda, who actually reenacted for me the loving conversation that she has with her animals each day as she's coming back from her fields. So they'll hear her and say, "My human is coming." Maybe they're saying, "My mother is coming. Give me something to eat." So she'll coo at them. She'll toss some grass to them and say, "Hey guys, are you little ones doing good?" And they say, what all this means is that for animals whose people were killed in the earthquake, it's like losing a parent. And that feeling goes both ways. Any way you look at it, says Nabin Thapa, who lost three goats and a baby buffalo in Tripursur. These animals are like our mothers. We drink their milk and get stronger. Even the old people among us are like babies to them. He shrugs and adds, "Nobody's even asked how many animals we've lost until now. I'm glad you're asking." As villages like Tripursur rebuild, people and animals alike are left to contend with their mutual losses. Meanwhile, back in Kaskikot, Amma and I are preparing an important ritual, the celebration of a new life. So there's this big metal pot, and then we're going to add this enormous pot of fresh milk to it, and it's going to be amazing. Since baby O'Neill was born 11 days ago, we haven't mixed her mother's sacred milk into any of our other food. On the 11th day, we held a ceremony to name the baby, just like we would for a human. Today, we can inaugurate its milk into our daily meal. Into the rice pudding it goes. Amma leans back against the clay wall of the kitchen. "These souls we're raising," she says. "Our souls just like our own." Our rice pudding is looking almost cooked. It looks so good. For the World, I'm Laura Spiro in Kaskikot, Nepal.
More to come. You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter with The World. Rumors are swirling in Poland that a Nazi-era train filled with gold has been discovered, and it's causing quite a stir.
Jedzie pociąg z daleka, złotem cały ocieka, bronią i...
A Polish pop star has even written a song about this train that's supposedly dripping with gold.
Teraz tylko, gdzie on
thing
jest.
Is, we're not really sure what's been discovered in Poland, if anything, at least not yet. My BBC colleague Adam Easton is in Warsaw, and Adam, help us separate fact from fiction here.
I'd just love to tell you the first four lines of that song, if you want. It gives you some idea of the story. It says, a train is coming from far away, dripping with gold, diamonds, and weapons, discovered by ground-penetrating radar.
Well, that is a catchy tune, isn't it?
Not quite Cole Porter, but it does tell you why the government is taking this particular claim seriously. Because this legend has been around for 70 years, since the end of the Second World War, that the Nazis gathered up gold, perhaps precious jewels, perhaps looted art, and put it on an armored military train in the city of Breslau in Lower Silesia, and hid that train because the Red Army was advancing towards the city of Breslau, and they hid it in an underground tunnel or somewhere underground. And people have been looking at the Polish state, and individuals have been looking for this for 70 years. And every 5 years you get another sort of claim saying, if we just tear down this brick wall, we'll find... And, oh, no, they never find anything. But this time, as I say, the government are taking it seriously. And the reason being is this ground-penetrating radar image, according to the Deputy Culture Minister, Mr. Piotr Żuchowski.
Okay, let's hear from that Deputy Minister of Culture.
Moja wiedza jest taka, że tam jeszcze nikt nie dotarł po wojnie.
The key thing he said that he was more than 99% convinced that the train existed because he had seen an image from a ground-penetrating radar, which he said clearly showed the shape of a train. You could see the gun turrets, he said. And he said it was more than 100 meters long.
I mean, why would he make this up?
It's not the first time this exact story has been claimed. But nobody has started digging or looking in this area in Poland yet. In fact, the authorities, local authorities, have just asked the Ministry of Defense for help from the army, and the army are preparing to go in there. Just with the usual maps and compasses and things, but go to the area and just do a reconnaissance of the area. And then they will perform their own imaging of the underground. Then perhaps start digging. But they're saying today that digging might not even start until the spring, next spring.
The place where this train supposedly is has been revealed, right? We know the name of the village where it is.
People have swarmed down there with their metal detectors trying to find this gold. And they're all looking in this area between the cities of Wrocław and Wałbrzych. There's a wooded area just off the railway line, just outside the city of Wałbrzych.
Adam Easton, I feel like we're keeping you from a big find now. You should be heading down there, right?
I've already been down there with my metal detection. I couldn't find it, so I come back down.
Okay.
There is not a scrap of documentary evidence. This is nothing more than a legend.
The BBC's Adam Easton on the ongoing gold rush in Poland. Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you.
Now to a very different mode of transportation. President Obama said this week in Alaska that we need more icebreakers, and pronto. The U.S. has fallen behind other nations in terms of resources in the Arctic. Our Coast Guard, for example, has just two operational icebreakers, and one of them is 40 years old. The other is newer and used to be under the command of Rear Admiral Jeffrey Garrett.
I was privileged to be the first commanding officer of that ship. Great ship, less horsepower than the older ones. It's not a real bruiser, but it's a very capable icebreaker and built with a lot of science capabilities so that it could become, you know, the U.S. Arctic research vessel. And it's served it very admirably in that role for the last 15 years.
And this may sound like a silly question, but we hear all the time that the seas up there are kind of warming up a bit and the ice is melting. Do we really need these ships?
Well, we do. Actually, the conditions are becoming much more unpredictable. With less ice during the summer months, you have more movement, you have more obstacles to access into the areas. And of course, there's an increasing amount of maritime traffic, human activity in the Arctic, everything from oil and gas exploration. And in the Antarctic as well, there's increasing interest in the science and in among the community of nations in establishing some sort of presence in that area. So even non-polar nations such as China, Japan, Korea, South Africa, India are building ice-capable vessels that can access these polar regions.
I understand China is building itself a huge ice-breaking ship. I wonder if that's spurring the U.S. on to act.
Well, I don't think it's so much a competition with other countries. I mean, many people bring out the scoreboard and say, you know, Russia has 41 icebreakers and building 11 more, and, you know, stats like that. But it's really not an arms race per se, but it's really, can the United States have the assets that it needs to support its national interests? And because we are one of five Arctic nations and because we have long-term enduring interest in the Antarctic, one old icebreaker and one newer one, you know, just isn't enough. Because if you can't really be on the scene, you're really not going to be a player in the long run. So I think it's vital for the country to get on with this.
Okay, Admiral Sluk, why is the U.S. so far behind?
Well, there's lots of organizational dynamics, political reasons, and so forth for making large dollar investments. And icebreakers are, quite frankly, expensive ships to build. To build one ship, although it's just a tiny drop in the overall federal budget, it's a very big hit on the Coast Guard's budget.
I wonder, Admiral, what it's like to be on one of these ships. I would imagine ships this big are pretty incredible anyway, but then you have the sort of powerhouse of being on this ship that plows through the ice.
Yeah, what I've enjoyed over my career going back into the 70s is just the absolute wonder of the polar regions and a chance to see places that there's really no other way to see it than to get out there on an icebreaker. And of course, what we always used to say is it's icebreakers are the only kind of ships where you're actually encouraged to crash into things. So it's a lot of fun to drive them and to actually operate in the polar regions and in the ice.
And is it just kind of a big snowplow on the water? You just power on and separate chunks of ice?
Well, it's just the shape of the bow really influences the efficiency with which you can ride up over thick ice and let the weight of the ship move downward and crush it and displace it to each side and then clear through the propellers so you can keep moving ahead.
Did you ever get beached?
Yeah, we've been beset it for short periods of time. Fortunately, never to the point where we had to winter over or anything, but that's something you want to avoid.
Yeah, wow. Thank you, sir. Rear Admiral Jeffrey Garrett commanded the icebreaker cutter USCGC Healy. Great pleasure to speak with you.
It's my pleasure to be with you today.
And it's always our pleasure to be with you. Thanks for tuning in. Remember, you can also keep up with us on Twitter. We're at PRI The World. I'm at World Aaron. Marco's at Marco Werman. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Aaron Schachter.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, including Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.